Hello, Damien Carrick with you. Welcome to the Law Report. Come with me on part three of my trip to the Kimberley in northwest WA. Addiction, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, loss of culture, a sense of hopelessness, mental health issues. How can we keep Indigenous people with these sorts of complex needs out of prison?
We certainly want to take those people that are caught up on pathways of vulnerability into programs where we can treat them for their illnesses and we can put them back onto pathways of resilience.
For Ted Wilkes, Chair of the National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Committee, it's all about Indigenous people being allowed to take ownership of their problems and then implement their own solutions. One place where this is happening is Fitzroy Crossing in the northwest of WA. Previously, we looked at this town's adoption of alcohol restrictions and how the Marninwantikura Women's Resource Centre tackles alcohol-fuelled violence. But alcohol can physically harm people even when there is no violence. And that harm can start before birth and be of epidemic proportions. In the Fitzroy River Valley, one child in three lives with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, brain damage or cognitive impairment caused to a fetus by excessive alcohol consumption by a mum during pregnancy. Each affected child has unique and complex needs. I'm now sitting in the playground of the Fitzroy Valley District High School, yes. And I'm speaking with Marmaji Hand. Marmaji Hand, you care for somebody with FASD. His name's Tristan. Can you tell me about him?
Well, Tristan, we have been looking after him since he was 5 months old, and now he'll be 16 in the end of the year. He's my nephew, but in Aboriginal context, he calls me Mum, so he's more my son.
And what are his special needs?
Tristan has got very complex needs, challenging needs. He's one of these young people who've had difficulties and issues in learning throughout his whole education journey from the time he entered kindy. Now he's in year 10 in high school. Thankfully, the high school here has built a fantastic support for him, and that's how he's coping. And sometimes he's coping like a 15-year-old, and sometimes he regresses back to a 10-year-old or 11-year-old. And he's got the needs of a young man sexually as well. So him trying to engage and really work with that and, I suppose, cope appropriately to the manners of the society that we live in. You need to work with the child from the beginning, scaffolding. If they don't come from that environment, understanding from right from wrong, he won't be able to cope. So, and that's why some of the children that we're seeing who are getting in strife and into trouble now, and some of these children who will end up in the justice system.
What kind of crimes, what kind of antisocial behaviour do you see with kids with FASD?
They're really quick to anger, violence, not understanding that, for example, that you cannot enter someone else's place and destroy it, you know, like it's on impulse. I'll go in there and do this, and the consequences, they don't connect the two. That's, yeah, it is all of those sort of social behaviours and problems that we are now seeing with those young people who have been diagnosed and are on the spectrum.
I've also heard that sometimes people with FASD are easily led, so people without FASD might get them to break into a house or lead them into situations where crime takes place.
That is true. Most of these children will just follow, or if they get into a group, for example, if they see a ball on top of a roof, for one of the children, you know, they know the dangers and the risk of that, but a FASD child will just climb up that without even thinking, without even knowing the consequences of falling off that. And that's a similar trait that they follow. They will follow anybody anywhere, whether it's wrong to do that. So, yeah.
Thank you, Marmaji Hand, for speaking to the Law Report. It's a great pleasure and a privilege to meet you.
And you too. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to now talk a little bit about FASD.
At the RN website at abc.net.au/RN, you can find a feature article on Marmaji Hand and her nephew Tristan, written by Ben Collins, ABC Kimberley's cross-media reporter. Ben's photos from Fitzroy Crossing are also on the website. You may remember in our last program we visited the Marninwantikura Women's Resource Centre. it's done an enormous amount to identify and address the needs of people with FASD, as well as to educate the community around the dangers of drinking during pregnancy. Of course, for a range of reasons, many young Aboriginal people do come into contact with the police. Scott Herring is the Men's Project Coordinator with the Yiriman Project, which is run by the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre, known as CALAC. He says it's crucially important to do everything possible to keep them off the criminal justice road that leads to jail.
14 years ago, I think the police went to some of the elders and they had a couple of kids who were sniffing petrol. They didn't know what to do with those kids. So they came to these elders, particularly Mr. Watson, John Watson, his brother Harry Watson, and Joe Brown in Fitzroy Crossing here, and they said, look, what can we do with these kids? And so they sat down and they thought, well, the only thing that we can really think of is to take these kids under our wings, take them out on country, and they took those kids out walking, you know, for a number of weeks. You know, initially those kids, their eyes were yellow, the kids went through the shakes, sort of withdrawals, that type of thing. But of course, they would have been pushed pretty hard by those old men, supported and that type of thing, but pushed along. They kept walking down to Mowler Bluff. And the story that Mr. Brown tells is, you know, a number of years later, he was at the local football and a young man came up to him and said, do you remember me? And he said, oh, no, not really. And he said, well, I'm one of those young boys who went out on that walk. And the way Joe tells it, he said, that boy was a really good football player. That boy looked healthy and strong and he was back engaging in the community.
So Yiriman works with young men to keep them in touch with their culture and maybe get them away from bad influences. You're often involved in sort of diversionary programs, aren't you?
Again, this is part of our thing, is that when people go into that justice system, it is a real trap. You know, you go to court and then you're on parole or bail or whatever, you have to ring into the parole people every week. You know, this is really difficult for some people.
There are a lot of conditions, and if you don't follow the conditions, you go to jail.
Yeah, and so it's the conditions that actually end up making more trouble and then more trouble, and every time they're falling further and further behind and further into the trap. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, with one of the magistrates in town, he asked the elders to sit in at magistrates' court, and so he'd come down from his high chair, and the lawyers would be there, and the police would be there, and a couple of our elders would be there. And so the kids, the juveniles in particular, would come into court. They were sitting across from their elders. So I suppose they felt supported, but they also knew that this was being taken seriously, not just by the police or by the justice system. It was being taken seriously by the elders as well. Sometimes we have sort of crime waves seem to happen. There was a time where a whole lot of guys were in trouble. There was probably about 15 or 20 guys who'd done a string of offences. That magistrate, working through that panel system, sat down and instead of sending some of those kids down to Perth and, you know, locking them up away, he looked for an alternative with the elders, and they decided to send the boys out to a small outstation. They were out there for about 3 months, supported by elders the whole time. They would have been doing a range of things. They would have had, if you like, lessons about things along the lines of respect, respect for other people, respect for yourself, respect for your culture and that type of thing. They would have gone and done hunting. They would have done work around the outstation. It was hard. You know, some kids wanted to run away from out there. But what we've noticed with the vast majority of those kids is they're employed or they're out on their communities working and they're no longer causing a problem. Because this is what we need to keep in mind. When the bosses say we don't want to see our kids locked up, the bosses also don't want places being broken into, cars being stolen. And I think when that panel was happening, that was a really good chance to be able to have an alternative option.
Scott, a final question. I've been to the West Kimberley Regional Prison. It's a state-of-the-art, very expensive facility, and from what I can tell, from what I've been told, not just by people in the prison system but by other people, it's an institution which is trying hard to address the needs of the people there. Do you think that's where we need to be putting the resources?
Okay, on the whole, I think the issue that the bosses have with the prison in Derby is, yes, they see it as a very expensive exercise. And I think that the story there is, it would be really interested to know, for what sort of offences and things people are being locked up for in the first place, and are they things that could be perhaps treated or prevented beforehand? So it might be for drink driving, it might be for not paying fines. And again, they're saying perhaps there are some ways around that.
You're saying maybe more resources at the front end?
Yeah, I think resources at the front end, for sure, to try and keep people out of prison. And then I think perhaps when people are coming out of the prison, you know, they could be coming and we could take them out to one of these outstations and have programs and things out there to try and reconnect them in. Clearly they need jobs as well, but I think, yeah, at the front end, and I think even as they're coming out.
Scott Herring from the Yiriman Project, based here in Fitzroy Crossing. As he mentioned, the diversionary program is not running right now at the moment. Many people with mental health illnesses find themselves revolving in and out of prison. In Broome, one organisation is trying to break that circle.
I'm here at the Broome Recovery Centre with Cameron North and with Elijah. Tell me, Cameron, what is the recovery centre here?
The concept sort of recovery is linking people back in with activities and social inclusion. We have a gardening group that we run during the dry season. There's a health group that's run on a Wednesday night. There's a couple of music groups and art groups as well.
And we're actually standing in the garden to the side of the recovery centre. Tell me, what have you got growing at the moment?
Thai basil, the normal standards basil. We've got some lemongrass, which grows all year round. Some capsicums and the ubiquitous chilli.
Right. Well, Elijah, hello. How are you going?
Hello, Damien.
Tell me, why do you come here?
I come to the recovery centre because of men's groups. All men come here to talk about things sometimes and study different things and go out fishing and do men's things. There's a few bad crowds in Broome. Broome's a bit bad. And I was actually, I was in prison. I suppose it's something that I can do to keep me out of trouble.
Why were you in prison?
I was homeless at the time. I did a unarmed robbery on a unattended shop at night time. Took the till and stuff like that. So it got me into a lot of trouble, and I was kind of confused at the time, and I handed myself in.
How long were you in prison for?
19 months, but I've also done consecutive times before that. I ended up in Casuarina Prison.
Down in Perth?
Yeah. Being in there, I just wanted to sort of fit so I didn't get into trouble. But I got into a couple of fights, and that's how I ended up in the protection yard where all these other guys were. And I ended up in Greylands for 5 months as well.
What's that?
Greylands is a mental institution hospital where they keep prison patients. They keep patients that just want to be in there because they're scared they might harm themselves and stuff like that. They shipped me back up north after my prison sentence. They found a lot of things for me to do, like sports and stuff like that, and during the day, activities. And then it got down to one of my uncles started coming here, and then he found a spot for me here, Uncle Jojo.
And what's it meant for any of your friends as well? Do they tell you that it's also important to come here?
Yeah. There's a place out of Broome called Millimanara. It's a place where you get off drugs and alcohol, and there's about 11 guys that they come to the men's group every Thursday. And sometimes when we go fishing out at the wharf, at the local wharf, they catch like most of the fish every time. I've seen most of the guys there. They look like they've had a hard time on the alcohol, but they've been off it for about a year. For about 2 years now, I've been off alcohol. I've quit cigarettes for about a year now. That's been my main goal, just to talk to them about that sort of stuff, because that's what it's all about.
Cameron, tell me, Elijah's got a great story. Tell me about some of the other stories of the people who come here.
We run some of those other groups where people come together, and it's more about talking and engagement. But we had
talking while you garden, talking while you cook, talking while you prepare the seeds.
Well, that's where I was going with that. It's rather than sitting around in those groups, there's some people that won't come along to those groups, but they feel more comfortable.
They don't want to sit in a circle in a dark room on chairs.
Absolutely. They'd much rather come and do something while they're here. So we have a few of the blokes in particular that come to the gardening group that don't come to any of the other groups, but they'll come here, and so we think that's a real positive as well.
Cameron North, coordinator of the Broome Community Recovery Centre. He uses a range of strategies to engage people like Elijah. Associate Professor Ted Wilkes, chairperson of the National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Committee, says programs like the ones we've just been hearing about are few and far between.
We have a distinct lack of programs that might be able to assist Aboriginal people out of their poverty and out of their disadvantage, but particularly in the alcohol and drug and domestic violence area, where we understand that these are all a cause and effect of what's happened to us over the last couple of hundred years. But most Aboriginal people are positive about our futures. But, you know, I say to you, there is a distinct minority of Aboriginal people who are caught up in a trajectory of trauma. We call it intergenerational trauma, but it's playing out, and we need to make sure that we bring those people to an appropriate standard of living.
When people do get into trouble, are there enough, say, diversion programs, like the Euroman project by Calic up in the Kimberley, which takes young people out onto country and away from trouble in towns? Are there enough of those sorts of programs?
No, there's a distinct lack of those sorts of programs. And in some regions, people put in an effort, and we noticed that the program you're talking about up in the Kimberleys is a good one. And once we set the standard in a particular region, other Aboriginal people would want to invest their energies and have governments invest resources into similar programs throughout Australia, so that Aboriginal people, our diverse groups of Aboriginal people, can have access to these diversionary programs, or these pathways of resilience, as I call them, that other Australians enjoy. We certainly want to take those people that are caught up on pathways of vulnerability into these sorts of programs, where we can treat them for their illnesses and we can put them back onto those pathways of resilience that I just mentioned.
I'm told that Indigenous men in the Kimberley especially are imprisoned for three types of offences: domestic violence offences, we've got driving offences, things like drunk driving and driving without a licence, and also property crime. When it comes to working with domestic violence offenders and driving offences, when people emerge from prison, are there sufficient intensive community-based programs that will keep people from re-offending?
No. A lot of what's happening with drunk driving and domestic violence is that pressure and the stress that I talked about, that people will self-medicate and alcohol and drugs comes to the fore. These aren't the normal behaviours of these human beings. So what we need to do is get these behaviours away from them. We have to talk fairly and squarely about what the impact of alcohol and drugs is on these people. And you can't do that in the home environment because it's just too clustered. There are too many others that are caught up in similar circumstances. So those people who go right off the rails, we need to take them away in a sense and put them into a secure community, family environment so we can nurture them back into those pathways of resilience.
How important is it for those programs to be Aboriginal run, programs by Aboriginal people for Aboriginal people?
Well, I maintain that the only way you're going to get out of a traumatic situation or the disadvantage that we talk about with Aboriginal Australia is to own your disadvantage, to own your poverty, to own your own stresses, and to understand that this is not normal and you need to own those so that you can then own the pathways.
Ted Wilkes, chairperson of the National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Committee. He's a speaker at this week's National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Conference in Melbourne. You're listening to The Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. What did you just say, Annette?
Good afternoon. My name is Annette Kogolo. I'm an interpreter and translator. I assist the non-English speaking person to understand what has been said to them in English.
Disadvantage plays a big part in bringing Indigenous people before the courts. And often when they actually front up to court, they're at another disadvantage. They don't understand what's going on.
I think they're scared. They don't really know what they're there for, and they find it really hard, and especially when the court sentencing them, even for driving without a licence, they don't really understand.
And what percentage of people, say, in Fitzroy Crossing would you say speak fluent English, and what percentage don't?
Well, not very many people speak English fluently. Most of them speak Creole, and some of them speak their own language or not speak their own language very well as well.
Creole's different everywhere. Is that an official language?
There's so many different Creoles, you know, that all over the world. But there's a Kimberley Creole, and most people understand and use. And Northern Territory Creole, so, you know, different jargons. Creole can be misunderstood if someone said, oh, I won't kill him, that person. But it doesn't mean that person killed that person. I mean, it probably meant I flogged that person, bashed him or her up. But that was one of the words used in Creole in the Northern Territory.
So you've got to be careful, like sometimes people who don't understand Creole will totally misunderstand what's being said.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, sometimes we have non-Indigenous people think they understand Creole. They think it's English, but it's not English. Yes, and that makes it really difficult.
Annette Cocolo from the Kimberley Interpreter Service. Sometimes courts and lawyers also get confused.
Oh, absolutely. This is something that actually crops up all the time in just the sort of cut and thrust of the magistrate's court, particularly with bail and things like that, where you're wanting to try and get the names and details, particularly for kids or young people, if they're going to go on bail to a particular relations house, particularly the really sort of remote clients that we work with. Bail often, not really ever, other than in like a court or a white authority context, call a particular relation by their white Christian name. They'll generally call them by their relationship name. So if they're like a grandmother, they'll say... It depends. There's different kinds of grandmothers. They might say Jaja, they say in Fitzroyan Halls Creek, or they say Jubby for grandfather. But mum is a good example. The way it's used here is it's used to describe your biological mum. It's also used to describe your biological mum's sisters, your biological mum and your biological mum's sister's first female cousins on the mother's side of the family, and so on and so on.
Ben White is the managing lawyer for the WA Aboriginal Legal Service in the West Kimberley. He says language is a huge issue, but so is culture. Non-Indigenous people simply don't understand the complexity of Aboriginal family and group relationships.
One of the issues that came up was that the alleged victim was sexually assaulted at a person she described as a Nana's place, never told Nana about it, but then subsequently told someone else and it came to the attention of the police. Now, the lawyer who was counsel at the trial, he, as is very common, tried to make something of that lack of complaint to someone like your grandmother. In the course of very early in the cross-examination, when he was putting things to her about, you know, why she failed to tell Nana, she ended up explaining, I only met her that day. They probably run into each other down the shops, figured out they're related, figured out the nature of their relationship. And it's a beautiful thing in Aboriginal culture that Nana might have just said, oh, come and stay at my place. But it never occurred to the lawyer, I'm sure it actually never occurred to the prosecutor or the police who took the statement, that the grandmother or Nana she was talking about, she'd only met a couple of hours before the alleged assault.
I guess this goes to the importance of language and everybody clearly being on the same page about what's actually taking place. I was in Fitzroy Crossing and I spoke to Annie Cogola, who is a registered accredited interpreter. How important are the interpreters in making sure that everybody is on the same page?
Look, they are very important, and particularly with cases involving people from really remote areas where their English is very poor. If you've got someone charged with a fairly minor offence where the information that's given to you as part of the first appearance brief, so to speak, tends to suggest it's a strong case, so the police statement may indicate that they've got four or five witnesses that saw someone pinching a can of beer from the pub, that sort of thing. If you've got someone whose English is poor but the case otherwise appears strong and the penalty's only going to be a fine or something minor, you need to weigh that up against, well, I could adjourn this for an interpreter, the chap stays on bail. If the chap's got no money, no motor car, no driver's licence, lives remote, means he may have to drive, you know, 300 or 400 k's to his community and then come back, drive 300 or 400 k's back for the next court date so that an interpreter is available at the next court date. That, of course, sets him up for risk of breach of bail, failing to appear in court, and they're the sorts of offences that can lead to time in custody. That's a scenario where I decide, oh, look, it's not worth getting an interpreter because the risks outweigh the benefits, effectively.
One final question. FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, how prevalent is that amongst your clients, and is it a contributing factor to some kinds of offending?
Absolutely. It's highly prevalent. It means that a person who's affected by FASD doesn't have consequential thinking, which basically means that a person can't link past punishment or the expectation of future punishment with current behaviour. So if you've got a kid whose mate say, let's go and do it, let's go and rob this service station, that kid just doesn't have the cognitive ability to be able to say, oh, last time I did that I got punished, so I shouldn't do it now, or think, oh, if I do this and I get caught, I'm going to be punished. So that makes it very difficult and contributes to offending. I also understand that one of the consequences can be that they're very easily led, and particularly with kids, they often offend in groups. There's a tendency just to simply go along with the pack, so to speak, or with the mob. Definitely contributes, and just how much it contributes, we don't really know yet.
Okay, Ben, so somebody is convicted for that kind of offence. Do they have detailed medical assessments? You'd want to be arguing this as a mitigating factor. Are you able to do that effectively?
Sometimes. And again, my understanding in relation to a proper diagnosis or a fulsome, definitive diagnosis of FASD, that it takes a long, long time. It takes several different assessments by a paediatrician and other medical professionals. One of the problems kids with FASD have is problems with memory and meeting appointments and things like that. That's exactly the sort of cognitive ability you need, one, to be able to comply with the court order, but two, to be able to actually get properly assessed. If you've got to go and meet with, for paediatricians, making four special trips to a remote community in Fitzroy to assess a kid for FASD, the chances of a kid, because he has FASD, actually being there for the four appointments is very slim. So it's a very, very difficult thing from a sentencing perspective, for defence, for the court, for everyone.
And the same kinds of balancing factors that you talked about with interpreters, do they also apply to this assessment process? Is it worthwhile putting everything off for 6 months and a kid going on bail and then potentially breaching those bail conditions? Are the same kinds of factors?
There's a massive tension you have in relation to your duties to the client, duties to the court, and also your duties where appropriate and where it's consistent with your obligations as a practitioner to follow instructions. So you know that means the kid's going to be on bail for probably several months, which means that every day, there's going to be police at their house at night checking the curfew. When you explain that to a kid, and more particularly when you explain it to his parents, that, look, this is what I'd like to do, I'd like to get this kid assessed, this could be really important for his sentencing, but then explain that that's the consequence, it means he's going to be on bail for several months, and these curfew checks that you're unhappy about are going to continue. Quite understandably, quite rationally and reasonably, most of the time they'll say, well, look, if we just deal with it today, what's going to happen? If your advice is, look, the kid's probably not going to get a custodial disposition, most kids and also most kids' parents will say, well, look, I'd like to get this dealt with. I'm sick of the police coming to my house every night.
And given that they might have difficulty working out consequences, they're less likely to comply with bail conditions than other kids.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, and they're precisely the sorts of kids that aren't going to last on a curfew, which means that they're more likely to be arrested, they're more likely to spend time in police custody, and they're more likely, if they continue to breach bail, to actually be refused bail and be remanded in custody, which means a trip down to Perth. There's no juvenile detention facilities anywhere in Western Australia other than Perth.
And Perth is over 2,300 kilometres away from Broome. Ben White is the managing lawyer for the WA Legal Service in the West Kimberley. Since that program was made, the WA government has announced that it will no longer fund the Kimberley Interpreter Service. The state's Chief Justice Wayne Martin, among others, have expressed grave concerns about the possible impact of this move. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to audio engineer Mark Veer. And a very big thank you to my travelling buddy Ben Collins, the ABC Kimberley's cross-media reporter, and to all the team at ABC Broome for generously sharing their knowledge about the issues covered. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.